Welcome back, everyone, to Millwood and Micah, A Star Wars Story. My name is Amanda Millwood, and I'm a screenwriter, actor, director, and a huge fan of Star Wars.
And my name's Todd Micah. I'm the author of the Grimguard book series, and we have never watched all the Star Wars movies in order with anyone. Until now. If you've been following along with our podcast, then you know that Amanda and I are going through all the Star Wars movies in the canon chronological order. And today we have arrived at the third of the Star Wars prequels, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. I know, we're really getting through these, aren't we? It's kind of amazing, even though it's a slow crawl, like episode to episode, because there's just so much to talk about in every movie. I am kind of looking back already and being like, what, three movies already? Like, really?
Yeah, right. Like, I feel like we just started.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not just the third movie. It's also celebrated as being the best of the prequel trilogy. But my gosh, it's also the saddest Star Wars movie by far. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get into that hardcore because this movie is dark.
It's dark. Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, some stats on it. It was released on May 19th, 2005.
How old were you when the movie came out? Because I can't math.
So my birthday is May 23rd. So this movie came out 4 days before my 20th birthday.
Oh, wow.
So wild. I was 19. I think I skipped, if I remember correctly, I'd have to remember what like day of the week it was. I think I skipped a college class to go see this. Oh,
totally valid. Like I take the whole day off and be like, shoot, I'm going to need it after this movie. Time to recover.
Yeah, I was bad. I didn't go with anybody either. I just saw it by myself.
Totally valid.
Yep. The movie is, of course, written by George Lucas and directed by George Lucas.
Your boy. He's the new It's Your Boy.
It's Your Boy, George Lucas. Yeah, and of course it has all the earmarks of a movie that is solely George Lucas's creation, but we will get a little further into that as we dig into the details. The official IMDb rating of Revenge of the Sith is a respectable 7.6 out of 10. And Amanda, if you will, take us away with those fun facts.
All right. And just as a note, as an aside, as I was looking on IMDb, because that's usually where I get my fun facts for all the episodes and movies and everything, this movie has an astounding lack of fun facts on IMDb. You would think that out of all the Star Wars, well, maybe not all of them, like I think the OG probably has the most fun facts, but like you'd think with Revenge of the Sith, which is, you know, pretty highly regarded nowadays, it'd be flooded with fun facts. But no, there was like 10, and they weren't even that interesting. So sorry, guys, I had to pick the best ones out of that. So better
fun facts. A quick jump in, I think one of the reasons why we suspect it is probably because it's the most memed Star Wars movie of all of them.
I mean, that's totally true.
All the fun facts about it came after the movie was out, probably.
All right, so for our first fun fact, the sound of General Grievous's coughing is George Lucas's own coughing. After developing a bad cough during production, Lucas had it recorded and used as Grievous's own cough. That is, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, first of all, the cough is just stupid. So, like, it's funny to me that he was like, oh, I'm like dying of a cold. Record that shit and put it in the movie.
Hey, Ms. Millwood, remember what I said not even 5 minutes ago about having all the earmarks of a George Lucas movie?
Yep.
There are some things there very uniquely George Lucas. We love you, George. Never change.
All right. Our second fun fact, also George Lucas involved, is that George Lucas deliberately made the Darth Vader suit top-heavy, for instance, adding weight to the helmet to make Hayden Christensen appear not too accustomed to it in the movie, which I think was an interesting choice, because, like, I'm sure that the outfit itself in the OG trilogy was, you know, pretty cumbersome, lots of pieces, but I'm sure it wasn't heavy in that sense. It was just, like, a lot of pieces. But, like, you can tell that just by the Frankenstein way that he moves, which is totally like makes sense given his, you know, the condition of his body at that moment. Like, I think that was a pretty interesting choice to actually physically make the suit heavy so that it made it hard to walk in. Like, that's interesting
And
for a reason.
I do love stuff like that. See, this fun fact I didn't know. I think I remember vaguely at the time, maybe hearing something about Hayden Christensen saying how heavy the helmet was, but I didn't know that it was intentionally done that way. I do kind of like when in movies when they do that. I wanted to say four actors, but I guess two actors. They put them in a situation that helps them. It's an acting aid because think of it, Vader in the suit. All of a sudden, you can't feel like the lower one third of your body. Like, all you can actually feel is what remains of your torso and shoulders. So, you are your sense of where your body is in relation to your center of gravity is way off.
It kind of reminds me, skipping way ahead, but it kind of reminds me of the interviews that Adam Driver did with for The Force Awakens, where, you know, the actual Kylo, the full outfit was so like layered and cumbersome to get on that by the time that he got it all on, he was so pissed off he was like in character. It's like,
That's
I
great. I also didn't know
love
that.
that shit. Oh yeah, oh my God, I love that interview. It's so funny. So for our third and final fun fact, and this one was my favorite, hence why I put it last, Ewan McGregor and Hayden Christensen trained for 2 months in fencing and fitness in preparation for their epic battle. As a result of their practice, the speed at which Kenobi and Vader engage in the duel in the completed movie is the speed at which it was filmed. It was not digitally accelerated. Oh, I'm fanning myself, everybody, right now.
That's
Like, that's just
insane.
hot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
I'm kind of fanning myself. That
But yeah, that is incredible. Not only just incredible feat of like, you know, physicality, being able to do those crazy moves that fast, like, you know, the way that we see it in the movie, but just like to me, okay. Well, all right, here. Well, we're gonna get to it, but
Amanda's
everyone's
overwhelmed.
I love this movie, guys. Okay, you go ahead. I know you had a point you wanted to get to first,
Oh
so
yeah, no,
let's get into
we
those.
have a bunch of things to talk about. And what's really funny was, there's several really, really big topics on this movie. So before we get into the minutia of the topics themselves, one thing I just wanted to say, Amanda, is I think Revenge of the Sith is especially striking as I was watching it today. And I realize that I've always thought this. I think it is the most visually jaw-dropping Star Wars film of all of them. Like the
Okay.
pan hold on, the panoramic views of like hang on. That I know you're still excited, but what I'm talking about is like every shot, you can stop the frame at virtually any frame of the movie, and it's like a picture, it's like a painting. Like, yeah, there's so many picture, excuse me, there's so many shots that are like framed against Coruscant skylines that are sparkling and beautiful. I mean, they really in this movie perfected the way Coruscant looks. Like they've had, six years, debatably, more than that to perfect the way it looked. And it looks incredibly gorgeous. There's the city backdrop of Utapau and the canyons and everything there. There's any of the shots during Order 66 of the various worlds everywhere. And I re and it's re really in good focus in a lot of shots. And it's just like and some particular shots are really framed really beautifully. I think one of the underappreciated shots of the movie, because it happens so early on and it isn't integral to like a battle scene, is the shot after Anakin gets up. Well, I mean, it's really, you could just freeze frame it on his abs and like that's maybe what I'm talking about, but it's not it. It's after he pulls his bathrobe on and then he goes and sits in like the pavilion outside of his apartment. And when he does, it's like this shot, beautiful shot of like the lights coming on and the fountain going and Coruscant in the background. It's just, you could frame it, put it on a wall.
Beautiful. Yes. Now, see, this is interesting because we've talked at length about pretty much all the Star Wars movies, and especially this one. And I could have sworn that, like, years ago when we were discussing this movie, you said that it was the most boringly shot. Like, I can swear that we had this conversation, which is why I was
I have I admit that I have a little bit of a conflict over two very strong opinions about this movie. I think that the movie overall is a jaw-dropping, beautiful visual spectacle. My big complaint, which I did voice when I talked and when I praised the Phantom Menace's cinematography, was, and I think I touched on this when we did Attack of the Clones too. I noted how in Attack of the Clones, things, the effects and stuff start to look a little plasticky, and it's, in my brain, it starts to look a little apparent that they're just being green screened everywhere, as I mostly criticize the lighting. And I still have that same criticism over Revenge of the Sith. It was even more glaring since I had just talked about it today. Then I'm like, okay, can we do something different though with the lighting? Can we stop with the everybody being kind of half lit, but from any given direction, and the lighting is almost always like a cool white, and debatably like a soft golden kind of hue. But other than Mustafar, there's like no colored, no mood lighting. Like, one could argue that there's like, oh, they make a lot of use of shadows on the movie. But yeah, but they don't vary it a whole lot. It's always kind of the same thing. It's just repetitive. It's just the repetition of it that for my eye, I'm just like, guys, can we get a little like atmospheric with this? It looks like we're just standing in somebody's garage under fluorescent lights. You're just aiming them different sides. Like, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It just, that's why I was so shocked when I was reading your one of your first topics. I was like, oh, okay, well maybe he's like changed his mind. Good. Because
Yeah, no.
I personally, just kind of piggybacking off of your point, like I don't think it's the most visually stunning. For me personally, I think that would be Force Awakens. I absolutely love J.J. Abrams' style of filmmaking in that movie. But I would say it's like probably top three most visually stunning to me. It certainly has the most iconic shots, I will say that. Like I think out of all of Star Wars, like probably to me at least, one of the most iconic shots right up there with the binary sunset is the shot of Anakin and Obi-Wan and the lava erupting behind them as they clash their sabers. Like that to me is mwah, peak Star Wars picture right there.
I
It's something
think
that
one
I
of
want like painted on my wall. So good.
the I
Not just
think
a
the
picture, I
reason
want it painted.
like actually you could probably paint it. You're a good artist yourself.
I probably could. Yeah. I've never done a mural, but I probably could.
Just get you a big loft apartment with a big like 30-foot stone wall at the back with plaster on it and let you go to town with some paint. Yep. You'll be like Miles Morales into the Spider-Verse, just graffitiing the whole thing beautifully. I think part of why I feel this way about it, and while I agree with you that The Force Awakens is beautifully shot and the color palette's really beautiful, I think more what evokes this sense for me, because I was internally about to rebut your point, but I'm like, but why do I feel so strongly that Revenge of the Sith is so jaw-droppingly beautiful visually? Revenge of the Sith, what makes this happen is that the backgrounds are very detailed and very dense. At any given point, they're not just standing with some trees behind them, like in The Force Awakens, or with a wall behind them, like in The Force Awakens. There's always a really busy background, Coruscant skylines, armies of battle droids, lava mountains. Like, there's always some epic landscape as the backdrop, and I think that's what makes me think that. I think I've kind of unpacked that a little while we're talking.
Yeah, I mean that's valid. Totally true. But I was 7 years old when this movie came out. This was the first, like I'm gonna be fully biased here. I am very biased because I saw this movie as a 7-year-old kid and it completely blew my mind. It was the first PG-13 movie I ever saw in theaters, and I was like shaken to my core. I was shooketh.
Well, sure, you were 7 years old watching a man burn alive.
Yes, and decapitate people. Oh yeah, by the way, speaking of being shooketh by this movie, my sister Rachel, she's only a couple years younger than me, so she was about 21 when we watched this movie last together.
Yeah.
And I guess that she hadn't, maybe she had never seen the movie, or maybe only had seen parts. Like she knew about the story, she knew what happened, In the movie, because we were doing a prequel, like full prequel watch together. And when we got to Revenge of the Sith, I was so excited because I didn't know when the last time, if she had ever seen the movie, she had watched it. And so I was wanting to see what her reaction was because she only really knew about the memes and just the overall story of what happens, like the fall of Anakin. And so, literally 20 minutes in, we get to the scene of Dooku being decapitated by Anakin. And I swear her jaw just fell to the floor. She was like, "He just decapitated a guy." And I'm like, "Yeah, this is the movie you're in for." And then we got to Order 66 and the slaughtering of the younglings. And she was actually crying, like full on tears, like, "Why is this happening?" And then, yeah, by the end,
Oh
she
my
was,
gosh, guys, I think she's crying.
yeah, oh my gosh, she's crying. Yep, literally. And I'm just like laughing maniacally, like, yep.
That tracks. You're
Yep.
literally Palpatine. You're just sitting there on the other side. I
I
can see that. You're sitting on the other side of the couch, just
Yeah, just like but yeah, no, it was just so funny, and I will never forget that watch experience of her experiencing that for the first time, like I did as a 7-year-old. Like, I was so shocked, but I honestly, I love it for that. Like, I love that this is the darkest Star Wars movie because I'm into that shit. But also, like, that they weren't afraid to go there because it'd be so easy to, sanitize this and, make it not so like bleak and dark and,
Well,
violent for PG-13
that's what
movies or
everybody's
whatever.
big, that's what all the Star Wars fans hated so much about The Phantom Menace was that it was so light and silly and, what's the word I'm thinking of, whimsical at times. And, and Star Wars fans who were their last exposure to Star Wars was either A, Return of the Jedi itself, which is, I mean, it ends with some pretty, some, I mean, it's a celebration, but also some really bleak moments in the movie, and the really heavy drama, and all of a sudden we have like what many fans, yourself included, consider kind of like a kiddie film. It's aimed for little kids. A lot of it is centered on that, like George Lucas said, it's a film for kids. And yeah, it really is a big shift between episode one and where we wind up here in episode three.
Yeah, very big, and I love it. Like, 'cause again, I love when Star Wars, like, I love the light stuff. Force Awakens is my favorite Star Wars movie, and I would consider that pretty light for Star Wars. But I do love when they decide to really get into the nitty-gritty and become much more adult, because I think it's an interesting twist on what Star Wars is, with Revenge of the Sith, Andor, Rogue One. Like, these movies are and shows are some of my favorite Star Wars because it's taking it in a different, darker, more adult direction. But it's not just being dark to be dark. Like, it'd be so easy to make a super gritty, like Blade Runner 2049 Star Wars style movie with no real substance outside of, oh, it's so dark and gritty. It's like, okay, and but these movies and shows have like actual reason to be dark. It's the fall of Anakin Skywalker and the death of all the Jedi, like the fall of the Jedi. Rogue One is a literal war movie where we see it on the ground, like soldiers being blown and killed up, blown up and killed left and right, including all of the main cast, which is, just so heartbreaking. And Andor, same thing. It's a kind of spy thriller, political thriller type movie, and, in a very gritty post prequel world. And it's like, yeah, I love that all of this makes sense to be dark. It's not just doing it to do it. So, yeah, but I absolutely love that this movie was not afraid to go there, and that it really does push, I think it pushes the PG-13 limit. Like, seeing Anakin's body being charred to a crisp, like, oh my God, that shit scared me so much as a kid. But like, again, I was like, I can't look away. This is so crazy that they're doing this in Star Wars. Like, what?
Yeah,
But
the elements that are there, like graphically, as far as like the decapitation and Anakin's immolation. I had to use the term immolation because that's the actual title of the track on the Revenge of the Sith soundtrack. It's the immolation scene.
oh gosh, dark. Oh my
Yeah,
gosh,
I know.
You want to know? So I thought that I had picked up on all the dark scenes and aspects of the movie until I did that rewatch with Rachel a couple of years ago, my sister. And like, there was one moment, it literally is just like a blink and you miss it, which is probably why I never caught it. But it like, I was like, oh my God, did you just see that? And she did. And it's the scene where Obi-Wan's looking through the files of the Jedi archives or whatever. And he's watching just brief glimpses of Anakin and he's fighting the younglings. And there is a, again, blinking you miss it shot of Anakin. And he's like, with one hand, he's, got his lightsaber and he's fighting off the kids that are coming at him. But then with the other, I think it's his robot hand, he grabs a kid's neck as he's fighting. I'm just like, holy shit, Anakin. Like, I never saw that.
He just grabs like a guy by the neck and just starts hitting other guys with the guy.
He might have, I don't know. It was only like a second shot, but damn, I'm like, he really just grabbed a kid's throat with his metal hand. Is he what an absolute monster? Yeah, it's dark. It's so
Well,
dark. Straight up PG-13.
this is actually a funny, I think a very funny bit as far as this didn't make fun facts, but I don't know if you knew this. During that very scene you're talking about with the security holograms, one of the Jedi that you see him fighting, I think you can see him, he's got like long hair and a top knot. That character, if I'm not botching my expanded universe knowledge, is Syn Dreleg, who is the like sword master, the like top Jedi sword master and trainer at the Jedi Temple, and he's actually played by Nick Gillier, the stunt coordinator and master swordsman who choreographed all of the fights in the prequel trilogy. So they let him come in there with his amazing sword fighting, and I think there was actually supposed to be a scene of Anakin fighting him during Order 66. I don't think it was intended to be just relegated to the hologram recording, but when you see that guy, he's fighting with the top knot and the long hair in that brief shot you're talking about, that's Nick Gilliard.
Oh, nice. I did not know that.
Yep.
Good work, Nick, because like, we won't go too much into this because I feel like we've talked about this before with these movies, but like the particularly in this movie, like this movie has the best sword, not I was gonna say sword fights, they're not swords, lightsaber battles in all of Star Wars. Full stop. Like I do not care. I've literally thought this since the movie came out, and it hasn't changed. Like my opinion hasn't been swayed by the internet or anything like that. People suddenly coming to Jesus and realizing, oh, maybe this movie particularly is not bad at all, actually. I've always loved it, and I've always loved the lightsaber battles, and especially the Mustafar one, because that to me is again peak Star Wars lightsaber battle. And some people, like my dad, will complain that it goes on for way too long and that there's no tension or like characters that you care about. And I'm just like, I'm like clawing at my face. Like, what do you mean? I mean, I'll
Well,
grant you, it might be a little long, but like, it's cool. So who cares? Like, at least these are characters that we have literally been watching for three movies now. This is the culmination of everything. This is the fight for Anakin's soul, for his redemption. It's like, oh, why aren't you getting it?
on that note, now I'm like on a roll with extra fun facts because I don't know if you were aware of this. Since we're talking about it, it does go on for a long time. In fact, the duel in Revenge of the Sith between Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi is the record longest sword fight in cinematic history.
Hell yeah, as it should be. Isn't it like 8 minutes? If you obviously it's broken up by a bunch of other scenes, but like if you combine the whole thing, I think it's like 8 or 9 minutes long, which is again insane when you look at how fast and how hard these two actors are going at it with just like nonstop, one awesome move after another, full force. Like it just I love it. I could watch it all day, every day, and never get tired of it.
It's actually really funny for additional just for additional fun fact just because it's also on there. No, this is like a sub fun fact. Previously, I think the longest previous to this, the longest just fight in cinematic history prior to the Revenge of the Sith battle was from another one of my very favorite movies, The Quiet Man, starring John Wayne, with a fist fight that is actually 7 minutes long.
Oh my God.
It's great.
The
But
boss movie.
Watch it sometime. It's really good. You'll see. I don't want to spoil the don't want to spoil the big
Okay.
finale. But on that note, especially since this is the last Star Wars movie, I feel like we would be in the wrong if we didn't take a moment to applaud Nick, and I correct myself on his name. It's not Gilliard, it's just Gillard. There's no I, it's just Gillard. Because this man not only brought us all the fights of the Star Wars prequels, but he actually has been the stunt coordinator, the man behind some of the best action of the era. Let me just read off real quick. This man has done was a stunt coordinator. I'm just gonna go from Phantom Menace forward to let you know other notable titles he's worked on. He did he was the stunt coordinator for Sleepy Hollow, Shaft, The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones, one of my favorite movies, another of them, Reign of Fire. He did, of course, the other two Star Wars prequels. He did Wrath of the Titans. He did a bunch of Black Mirror episodes. He did Da Vinci's Demons. He was a stunt coordinator for The Alienist, the series that came out a few years ago. The War of the Worlds, The Dark Tower. He's done some really, really notable things. Star Wars is where he really took front and center, where he was very visible and people knew his names and his name in the fan community. We all knew Nick Gillard. But no, he has continued to work on things even up to this day. He's a stunt coordinator on a series that came out just last year called Grace. But this guy is responsible for the quality of the duels that we see in the Star Wars prequels. So, the proverbial hand of applause for this man.
Yes, good job, Nick. You killed
On that note, we there's a lot to talk about with this movie, but I feel like we should just there's a lot to praise it for, but why don't we dig into the biggest note of the entire movie? Because this is definitely something to talk about, and that is simply the manipulation of Anakin Skywalker. I mean, where do you even want to begin with this? Because there's so many different parts to take it from.
Well, let's start with you actually, because it's your spoiler favorite scene, as you wrote down.
Yeah, it
That's
is.
really kind of where the whole thing, like, obviously he's been doing it the entire Palpatine's been manipulating him the entire trilogy, but this is really where the seed is planted in this one scene. So you
Yes,
want
and
to
to
talk a
bring it
little bit
to
about it, we can just go from there.
yes, to bring it to everyone's memory, it's this moment that I think we might remember that starts. Have you ever heard the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise?
Oh, God.
Yeah, it is my favorite scene, and I feel like in all aspects, it sort of encapsulates what the temptation of Anakin Skywalker really is. The entire scene is just a masterpiece. It is my favorite scene of the entire prequel trilogy. Until we've gone through the rest, I'm not going to say it's my favorite scene from all of the Star Wars saga, but I, at the moment, another one does not spring to mind, short of other than like the Bespin gantry scene in The Empire Strikes Back, the scene of Star Wars. But this one is right up there with it, probably second place, because Palpatine and Anakin are there at the Opera House. And I even love the exchange of words they have beforehand, because he starts to pick away at Anakin's faith in the Jedi when he, of course, coming off as just being really shrewd and very perceptive and very empathetic, he's like, the Jedi Council asked you to do something dishonest. They asked you to spy on me. And Anakin feels very conflicted, and so he already sets him to feel off balance. He's undermined him. He's undermined his trust in the Jedi by pointing out and making them seem like bad guys. But then he also steps in with the like, it's sort of like a, how did you know that? That it's so disarming, it puts Anakin on his back foot. And then he just kind of, Palpatine just kind of digs right in with, the whole Oh, well, the Jedi and the Sith are alike in almost every way, including their quest for greater power. And he really pushes Anakin on that, trying to get him to think that, oh, well, the Sith and the Jedi, it's they're basically the same. What's the big deal of turning to the dark side? Because all you're doing is just switching religions, but like you're switching from Catholic to Lutheran, like you know what I mean? So there are some things that kind of translate over. And so it's interesting to think that that was Palpatine's first go-to plan for how he was going to approach this. But then Anakin turns on him and says, you know, the Sith only think about themselves. And Palpatine's like, well, the Jedi don't. And, you know, challenging that. And Anakin just counters, and you see his composure has been regained as he really stonily looks at Palpatine and says, the Jedi are selfless. They think only of others. And he just shuts it down. And I like how there's that long, tense silence, don't you, of him just like re-strategizing how he wants to go about this. He can't go that route. Anakin morally is still too strong. He can't appeal to him on the basis of amorality that, oh, these two belief systems are basically the same. The Jedi are corrupt and the Sith are not as bad as you think, and so they're interchangeable. But you realize that Anakin is too morally bound still at this point to do that, and so he resorts to a very clever story, the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. And one of the best things, my favorite moments in it, is when he tells the story of Darth Plagueis having the power to save the ones he loved through the powers of the dark side. And then he just like, and I almost view this as almost like a slip up on his part. Like he kind of almost outwits himself when he gets caught up in the story and he's like, oh, well, whatever happened to him? He's like, oh, well, you know, he was afraid of losing his power, of course. You know, of course, the problem is he taught his apprentice everything that he knew. And then he says something he totally doesn't have to, but in this moment of just deep, sinister arrogance, he has to indulge himself and say, then his apprentice killed him in his sleep. Ironic. He could save others from death, but not himself. And you watch that sly
Congratulations, you
smile.
played yourself.
Right? But come on, you see that same sense, don't you, from when you watch the scene?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like there is a bit of that arrogance slipping in at that very moment of like, yeah, I did that. Like I'm the one that, has the power. And like I think I actually when I was before I did film school, I just did community college, and I had a what's it called? Like a speech class, and I was the best student in that speech class, I'll have you know. And so we had to do a persuasive speech, and but we could it wasn't like a typical persuasive speech. It was one where we had to take a persuasive speech from a movie or a show or something, and we had to kind of dissect it and like basically decide if it was good persuasive speech or not. And of course, me being me, this is a group project, by the way, but I completely took over. I'm sorry, group. But like I was like, we have to do this. Like just totally none of these people had ever seen Revenge of the Sith. They're like, what is this? And I'm like, it's from Star Wars, don't worry about it. And
Yeah,
so
guys, trust me, bro. I know what I'm doing.
literally, I did the entire project and they did nothing, and I'm sure that they were fine with that. But like when we had to
Yes.
present, they were just like, yeah, what she said. But yeah, I took the whole speech, the whole, Darth Plagueis tragedy speech, and I broke it down as to why it was a great persuasive speech, and kind of the way you just did of like, he's not taking the direct approach, he's using basically, what is the Star Wars equivalent of a fairy tale to kind of break down Anakin's defenses and get him on his side and get him intrigued, plant that seed of like, oh, is there something to be done about these visions I'm having? And do you know a way to do it? And so, like, ultimately, yes, I think it is a great persuasive speech and just a great scene overall, very atmospheric. And is again the moment I think that Anakin begins the fall. Like he doesn't fully fall at this point, obviously, but this is the moment where the seed is firmly planted in his brain, firmly grasped it. And so, So like I ended up getting 100 on that. I said I because I did all the work.
Oh,
But
I'm
like,
sure. I'm sure. I
yeah.
wouldn't have. I mean, it is so brilliantly done, and you taking note of, again, like you said, the same things that I pointed out. I assume that those shifts in like strategy and, like you said, the manipulations, removing the underpinning of the morals to try to make the dark side appear better than it is, you know, all those things go into that. And on that note, you know, as storytellers, I know that you appreciate this the way I do, that, you know, I have an even more exact word than fairy tale. It's a fable, because fables are fairy tales that specifically have a moral at the end of the story, designed to use a metaphor, something that, you know, that what's being presented is not necessarily true. It's symbolic, you know, fables like the tortoise and the hare. Well, a turtle and a rabbit didn't actually have a race, but whether the historical accuracy of it is a moot point, because the point is that it's an illustration, in order to prove a point and teach a moral. And it's a great way to get in someone's head, because you're giving them something that they're going to sit and think about it and be like, oh, you know, what is the lesson I'm supposed to learn from that? It challenges you already to open a door yourself and challenge your own thoughts and perceptions and conclusions to learn something new. So it is very, I'm going to drop this one. It's very insidious.
But yeah, I absolutely love that scene, and I just love, like, can we just say Ian McDiarmid as Palpatine, phenomenal. Like I would say, and I mean this is kind of jumping the gun a little bit, my favorite character is Anakin in the movie, just because he's the one that goes through the arc, and you know he's the one that has the big fall and all that. But I think that, like, if we're just talking performance wise, like Ewan McGregor and Ian McDiarmid have give the best performances, like we can say that. But I think that because Ian McDiarmid specifically, he's playing such a wide variety of characters in this movie, and I love it. Like he swings so effortlessly from the that was not effortlessly said, from the suave politician whispering in Anakin's ear to this like maniacal, genocidal, like monster. And it's incredible like how much he's willing to ham it up, but how it doesn't like detract. Like you'd think in a lesser hands of, in the hands of a lesser actor, hamming it up that much would come across very poorly and like very just totally mood ruiner. Like this is funny. This isn't like, horrifying to watch or anything, but somehow, Ian McDiarmid, despite it technically being funny out of context, like these moments where he's being absolutely hamming it up and being a total monster are like truly terrifying. It's like, oh my God, this guy is the most evil thing in this world. And he's just
He
like a guy.
and I'll even jump in and to second what you say. Not only does he swing back and forth between this charismatic, hello, my turn to stumble, charismatic, you know, president of the galaxy here, winning hearts and shaking hands and kissing babies and subverting Anakin Skywalker's whole future. To, again, like you said, this cackling maniac, but he also along the way has to play, you know, helpless captive at the beginning, where he's like, oh, you should get help, he's a Sith Lord, or you know, and he even has to verge on like the leadership role, where he's a little firmer, where with Anakin he's like, leave him, there's no time. But then he also has to play the victim later in the scene that we're referencing, where he transforms into this monster, where he's also at first just playing victim again, and he's like, no, don't let him kill me. Like,
I have to take over. Remember
it's
that
one of
line.
the
Why is every single line out of that man's mouth iconic? Like he's just one of those characters that every freaking line is memed into oblivion, and I love it.
It's so good. It's the way we honor him, and the way we will honor him for eternity. Like, he's
Honestly.
Honestly, I mean, here's the thing. Revenge of the Sith is the most memeable film, and we know this because the memes from it are still alive and well as if the movie came out last year. Other movies, the memes come out from like screenshots of the movie when it goes to digital and stuff, or like, and like they fade in like a year or two, but Revenge of the Sith is forever.
Is forever. It's true. Even my dad, who, as I've said a million times, does not like the prequels, he will quote Revenge of the Sith. I think it's because I have embedded it in his brain because I quote it all the time, and it's just like he now finds it so funny that like I quote it constantly. So he will, I'll call him back home in Texas, and he'll just answer with "Hello there." And like, just so many quotes, just little lines like that, that obviously we are iconic Star Wars fans, but it is, when it gets to that level, when someone that doesn't even like the movie is quoting it, like, that you've reached meme godhood.
No, there's so many just one-liners from the movie. Another happy landing. This is where the
Yep.
fun begins.
Literally. Or my dad's favorite that he loves to cringe at, "This is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause." It's like, not even really a funny meme, it's just like, he just thinks it's like, oh, it's such an awful line. Why do people say it?
It's such a good, again, they're like, you could say they're throwaway lines, but as the value of them increases in meme currency, like they become priceless. You take any meme, any line from Star Wars, buried in the sand for 1,000 years, becomes priceless.
Literally.
And that's an Indiana Jones reference, in case you didn't know.
Yes, no, I got it. You got me. Oh my goodness. Okay, speaking of lines, like, I just want to get this off my chest because this is my hot take, everybody. And it's not like, I don't know if it actually is a hot take. I just feel like I see this everywhere. And it involves the line of dialogue at the end of the movie where Padme has not yet died, but she is dying, and the doctor droid comes out and tells Obi-Wan, "She's lost the will to live." She's always your Dr. Ball. She's lost the will to live. But stupid robot chicken parody. But I fully agree. That line is very stupid, that line of dialogue. But my hot take is that Padme dying in childbirth actually makes complete and total sense given the terrible condition that she is when she arrives at the hospital on whatever planet that is.
The hospital planet.
Yes, the hospital planet, which I always thought was Kamino, but it's not. Like, it looks just like
No,
Kamino to me.
it's people don't give birth on Kamino. It may be the baby planet, but it's like it's the petri dish planet, okay?
Yes. But so people are always like to pick apart that line and the, she's dying of a broken heart, whatever. And I'm like, okay, the people that complain about this are men. Let's just say that.
And
Because
really quick, let me jump in. They've lost the note of the fact that this, once again, like you say, Star Wars is a space fairy tale. It's space fantasy. In Beauty and the Beast, the original telling, he just dies of a broken heart because he tells her, if you don't return X amount of time, I'll be so sad I'll die.
Yep, literally. But even without the fairy tale context, which it totally is, I'd say it's more of like a tragic fairy tale. But this poor woman, she doesn't realize that she's pregnant with twins, which is already probably putting a ton of stress on her body and her as a person. But then she finds out that her beloved, dear, perfect husband, Anakin Skywalker, is a Sith Lord and has just murdered a bunch of children in a mass genocide of the Jedi. So she's kind of in denial right now. She goes to the planet to talk to him about it, see, clear some things up. And then she gets choked out so much that she literally passes out for the entire fight and stays passed out until she gets onto the ship with Obi-Wan. That's not good. That's not good.
Yeah,
So that'll be.
people who want to talk about like the realism of that involved, I totally am on board with you on that, because one of the big things I've always pointed out to people for years is one of the stupidest tropes, if we're talking realism in anything, film, TV shows, is getting hit on the head and getting knocked out for like a couple of minutes, and then you just shake it off and you're fine. My brother in Christ, if you have lost consciousness, if you have lost consciousness, you have brain bleed or a concussion at least.
Yes. And it's like, and I'm guilty of that. I literally have that happen in my own script at the moment, but.
But you can get away with it. But the point is, if you're going for realism, just like you're saying, she was choked to the point of losing consciousness. That's not good for anybody, much less a pregnant woman.
Yeah, and then collapsed on the ground with all daintily like a princess. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, she literally does like the fall on the bed.
Make sure you make sure when you fall that you fall face up so you, the camera can see you.
He looked fabulous, even while passed out. But yeah, no. And then on top of that, yeah, just actually giving birth. Even if you're the healthiest woman ever, giving birth is incredibly dangerous. And a lot of women still to this day do die in childbirth because of bleeding or tearing or, you know, post, you know, surgery, whatever. Like there's so many factors that go into childbirth that can make it deadly. And like, again, it drives me crazy that people just get so up in arms about Padme dying the way that she did. It's just the stupid dialogue, guys. If you take away that one line of she's lost the will to live, nobody would question it. Like, I really don't think anybody would. And again, like, it's just a little thing, but I just have always felt very strongly about that because I love Padme as a character, even though she was done dirty in this movie. So, like, I just needed to protect my girl and say my piece about her for that 1 minute because it always makes me mad.
Yeah. And speaking of things about Padme making you mad, though, I feel like there's something else that you alluded to and you might as well go off on it while your blood pressure is still high. But so don't worry, guys, we won't let her get so deep into the complaints about this when I'm about to bring out the sheet that Amanda loses the will to live or anything like that. So, and that is how dirty they do Padme, where she has gone from scrappy queen protecting her planet in episode one to, you know, kick-ass senator in you know, episode two, running around and shooting droids and, you know, taking names and romancing young Jedi. And here she's like, stand around, be sad or generally concerned or be concerned about and otherwise be completely useless.
Yeah, and you know what? This kind of actually leads into my general grievance. You may be like, how does that lead into that? But
knowing what it is in advance, I'm actually completely dumbfounded. So yes, please.
Yes. So my general grievance for this movie, because again, I love it dearly. It's my second favorite Star Wars movie of all time, is that the first act battle should have been cut down by 10 minutes. Like that battle goes on for about 24 minutes, I think, from the minute that the movie starts to when they like actually land on Coruscant and they depart from the ship and all that. So that's about 24 minutes. It should have been 10 minutes shorter because it's fun, but a lot of what happens is just like, we don't need it. It's nonsense. So my fix, and I'm sure it was a time thing because I actually was shocked when I rewatched the movie last night that the movie is only like not including credits, like 2 hours and 10 minutes, like right up there. Mm-hmm. 2 hours and 15, maybe, like, it was around there. I was thinking it was, like, one of the longer, where it was, like, 2 hours and 30 minutes plus. It's not. So I was so shocked by that. And I was like, okay, so I'm guessing that the reason that the first act, or the first battle, whatever, is so padded out, is because if you cut 10 minutes, that would basically make it a flat 2 hour movie, which, to me, is perfect. Like, that should have been the goal.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to keep it more than a 2 hour movie, because it's like the big finale, you know, you want to get every little bit that you can, take those 10 minutes that I would have cut from the first battle and put back in the scenes of Padme and my girl Mon Mothma plotting against Palpatine. Like there are so many great deleted scenes of like the political intrigue behind the scenes with Padme and her group of, you know, senators and politicians.
Right. Yes.
And I know I'm not the only one that feels this way, but this is why it kind of ties in with Padme. It's like, you could have put that time, that 10 minutes, towards something better if it was just keeping the runtime the same.
Yeah, and for any listeners, by the way, who are not acquainted with what she's referring to, there were deleted scenes that were fully filmed and everything for Revenge of the Sith that you can find on like the extras DVDs of Padme conspiring with a young Mon Mothma, who, for people who don't know the name, she is the leader of the rebellion from the from Rogue One. She reappears in Return of the Jedi, so she is from the original trilogy. She's there in the briefing room aboard the Rebel ship, planning the attack on the Death Star, and then she reprises the actress from Rogue One. Is the same actress that filmed the scenes that originally were going to be in Revenge of the Sith, and it was going to be Padme and Mon Mothma and, correct me if I'm wrong, but also Bail Organa, right? Like, kind of forming the secret, like, Palpatine has got too much power now, it's time to, you know, band together and secretly be against him, and how do we stop him, and, you know, there needs to be a rebellion, basically. Not in so many words, but that's basically what is said, and they're great scenes. I again, I'm with you, I wish that they would have been fleshed out more and put in the movie. And the whole space battle and this opening scene that you're talking about, this is not a general grievance. I don't mind it enough to like have a an actual complaint about it. But the Revenge of the Sith space battle for me is like the pod race was for you.
Yeah.
So many people who love the prequels, the Revenge of the Sith fans are going to be on me for this one. But I find the Revenge of the Sith space battle amazing until people start talking. And then from that moment forward, I am instantly over it.
They literally talk within like 30 seconds.
No, yeah, completely. Like, they have the opening shot of the destroyer and the two fighters come in. I'm like, this is amazing. Awesome, this is so great. The one long extended shot, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely incredible. The spectacle of the Battle over Coruscant is wild. And for anybody who watched the Genndy Tartakovsky micro-series of the Clone Wars, the 2D animated Clone Wars, we knew that was coming because the Battle over Coruscant was teased as the last shot of the series. So we knew what we were walking into in Revenge of the Sith. I was there in theater pounding my seat being like, are we going to open with the battle? Tell me we're going to open with a giant space battle. And then we got it, and the crowd just roared in excitement because we'd all been watching it. It was
crazy.
Yeah, it was great. But as soon as people start talking, like, the energy level in the space battle just gets lower and lower and lower for me. And there's no dog fight. They just kind of like dip through the fighters, and then there's like half of the space battle is just little silly goofy spider droids running around the ship making like squeaky funny noises, and like there's comedy that half the time I don't know if it's intentional or if it's, and the jokes I'm sure about, for me, half of them don't land. So I'm like, what is the tone of this space battle? Is this funny or is it serious? Because we're like cutting really quickly back and forth between things like Anakin shooting the wing of his ship off and then being like, I agree, bad idea, almost kills his master. And then we just get them flying past some like horrific explosion of a ship with thousands of people dying. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be feeling. I guess I'll just wait. So I don't enjoy it. I agree with you. Please cut something out of the opening half hour. Cut out 10 minutes somewhere. Just do it.
Yeah, I think that, like, I would cut out all of R2-D2's stuff. Like, you know, I love R2-D2, but that stuff is just way too goofy for what is supposed to be a fairly serious fight. But I think that if you just cut little segments from, because the fight itself is kind of broken up into segments. You know, you've got the dog fight, and then they get into the ship. You've got R2-D2's little whatever. You've got the, you know, what are they called? The ray shield droid things, like, so like you've got sections of this fight, and I feel like if you just cut like a minute off of each section, it would flow much better.
As far as I'm concerned, you can go straight from them saying spring the trap to them walking into the room where Palpatine is chained up, and I would be 100% fine with it. No elevator jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then just have all the droids fill the room after they killed Count Dooku. Just have them run into a whole bunch of droids that corner them in the hallway and go straight to the bridge. Like,
Yeah, I'm sure that somebody's done a cut where that is exactly how it goes down, because I think it would have been better and much more concise, but kind of get to the point much faster. But yeah, that's really the only thing for me that, like, I would say brings down the score is that the first act, I think, just goes on for too long. Not even really just the first act, but just the first battle goes on for too long. And should have been cut by 10
I'm
minutes.
still
But that's
waiting.
my
I'm still
general.
waiting for how you're gonna link this to Padme being getting
No,
the shaft in this movie.
the link was that they should have cut the 10 minutes from the battle and given those 10 minutes to Padme, to those
Oh,
deleted scenes.
that was the link.
That was
Yes,
the link.
to give her more to do. Yes. Yeah, okay. And I definitely agree with you. I definitely agree with you on that, as I said. And on that note, we should honorarily make sure we keep up our tradition of noting before we run out of time here, our favorite Padme outfits, because that's it. And I feel like in after seeing the answers, I feel like it's only right that I go first because my favorite Padme dress in this movie is and it's hard to pick because they're not that great in this movie. Some of them are not so great. Not as glam, not looking as glam as they were in the last two. Come on, give me
Right.
that. They're not that glam.
Their pregnancy maternity dresses, give her a break.
I mean, like literally, like what's your favorite Padme outfit? Is it like the little weird khaki, like I'm going jogging, but for pregnant women, like I'm going on safari that she wears when she runs out to go see Anakin on Mustafar? Absolutely not. Come on now.
Actually, I do like that one, but no, it is not my favorite.
So my favorite one is actually the gown that she wears in the scenes during Order 66, where she is there at the temp, there at her apartment, and she's watching the flames if coming from the Jedi Temple, across the city, and she is there, weeping, worried about Anakin, and I believe she's still wearing that outfit when Anakin comes to see her to tell her that everything's all right, and it's just this really gorgeous, really light looking blue dress. It's got like a little short like cape, I think, on the back of it that goes to about mid back, and then her shoulders are bare. She has kind of a cold shoulder on either side. It's just really beautiful and really elegant, and it's not amazingly crazily bejeweled or anything, but it's so simple and at the same time intricate, and it's very fine, and I think it visually expresses her fragility in those moments that it looks so just like just dewdrop delicate.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I do love that one. But my favorite Sorry, I didn't realize I was jumping the gun earlier. My favorite is the last gown that we see her in all the movies, which is her funeral gown. I think that her funeral gown is stunning. And it actually is one of my favorite. It's not my favorite. The Meto gown is my favorite from Attack of the Clones, but it is one of my favorite of her outfits, and it does not get enough love just because we don't really see her walking around in it or anything, and she just is laying in the coffin with it. But oh my gosh, that's again something I would love, as macabre and morbid as it may be, that it's such a beautiful image, like of her laying in the casket with that dress and the hair and the flowers and obviously the Jafar snippet in her hands. Like, that's something I would want painted on a wall. It's so beautiful. And I love that the dress itself, I believe that the is it Trisha something? I'm sorry, Trisha, but the costume designer for all of the prequels, she said that the inspiration for the funeral gown was the water because of Naboo, and so it was supposed to look like she was floating in a river, dead. But and it also harkens back to Ophelia, which is one of my favorite Shakespeare characters, like the tragic, crazy woman that dies drowning herself. Like, I love the symbolism of that, and it again, stunning. I love that they brought back the Jaipur snippet, because like every time that the camera pans down to that, I'm just like, oh, my heart. But yeah,
And
so
in the spirit of the honorable mention, by the way, it is Trisha Biggar.
Bigar. Okay, I was thinking beggar, but I was like, I don't think that's
Close.
right, but that's close. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, Trisha, like, I don't believe that she worked on any other Star Wars movies as far as I know. So like this is your round of applause for your incredible like just costuming overall, but especially for our girl Padme, because wow. I can't wait till we get to Leia. Like she's gonna be the next one that we have to like pick a best outfit for. And then once we get to the sequel trilogy, we can just do best outfit overall because there's not a lot of variety, but yeah, so absolutely love it.
And I wanted to make sure that you went last with that because it is fittingly, it's the last dress we see her in. One additional note on that, it would have been kind of cool. I mean, I'm saying they should have added this, but like, had they had, oh, I don't know, a scene at the end of the movie, if they had done it differently, where like him as Vader sort of proverbially says goodbye to Padme one last time, like he sees her, how beautiful would that dress have been for her to be standing in it, sort of like, maybe reaching to like touch his face, or like him seeing her one last time standing, where we'd actually be able to see the entire dress, like you said.
Oh, I would have loved that.
There, let me th
I don't think I've ever seen the dress like on a mannequin or just like standing upright, not in a casket. Like, I want to see how it looks like fully flip, splayed out and like standing upright. Like I need to see that because it's so pretty just laying there.
You've never seen it. There's a whole thing right here. Here, I will dazzle you, and we will get live Amanda reaction. The live your live Amanda reaction here. Here's the dress.
Oh, it's so pretty. It looks so luxurious and comfortable too. I love that.
So now you've seen
Yes,
it.
fully. Yes.
But on that note, then we do want to save the rest of our commentary, including some more hot topics, for our next episode. So we'll just break things off here, and we will be back with much, much more about Revenge of the Sith in our next episode, guys. So we'll see you next week.
That's all for today. To all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, so feel free to leave a review or comment, follow the podcast, give us a good rating, and all that good stuff.
You can find us on Instagram at Millwood and Micah Podcast. And don't forget that our sweet podcast merch is available on TeePublic. Thanks again, and we'll be back in the next episode.